We're looking at Paul's second letter to Timothy. We've come to the last chapter, chapter 4. The charge that Paul lays on Timothy in verse 2, preach the word. I said we'd ask five questions about this command. Here they are again. What, when, how, with what attitude, to whom? What must Timothy preach? He must preach the word. He must preach the message of the Bible, the scripture which God has breathed out. That's what Timothy must preach. When must Timothy preach? In season and out of season. At times which seem suitable, and at times which seem completely unsuitable. At all times. That's when Timothy must preach. How must Timothy preach? He must preach in a way that's appropriate for all his different hearers. He must correct, rebuke, and encourage. He must correct those who need correcting. He must rebuke those who need rebuking. He must encourage those who need encouraging. He must match the message to the needs of his hearers. That's how Timothy must preach. With what attitude must Timothy preach? With great patience and careful instruction. With an attitude of patience and carefulness. Some of his hearers will be slow to understand. Some will be obstinate and miss the point of what he's trying to say. So he'll need to be very careful and very patient. That's the attitude with which Timothy must preach. We covered those four questions last week. And that leaves just the fifth question. To whom must Timothy preach? And the answer is given in verses 3 and 4. Timothy must be prepared to preach to people who don't like the things he's got to say. Paul warns him, verse 5, that the time will come, verse 3, the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. And yet Timothy will have to preach to them. As we've gone through this letter, we've seen that the situation among the churches in Asia, the part of the world where Timothy is working, the situation in those churches is already pretty awful. Just about all the churches in Asia had turned their back on Paul and what Paul stood for, which really means that they had turned their back on real Christianity. We saw that, for example, back in chapter 1, verse 15. Paul had to say there, everyone in the province of Asia has deserted me. They'd all turned against him and his sort of Christianity. But now, Paul warns Timothy that he can expect the situation to get worse. The time is coming, says Paul, when people just won't put up with sound doctrine. They won't put up with the sort of sound teaching that Timothy has to bring. At least Timothy is getting a hearing at the moment. He's recognized as a leader by that church in Ephesus. But Paul can see a day coming when people just won't listen at all to a man like Timothy. He'll be howled down the moment he opens his mouth. He'll be barred from speaking in the churches. Everybody will try to silence him. They won't put up with sound doctrine. Now, Paul isn't a pessimist. Paul has said in chapter 3, verse 9, that he believes that in the end, the false teachers will be defeated. Their folly will be clear to everyone. He believes that there will be a turning back to the truth eventually. He's confident that the truth will triumph, but not in the short term. Paul believes that things are going to get worse before they get better. The tide is going out steadily as Paul writes this letter, and it's going to go further out before it turns. That's Paul's analysis of the situation. These verses, verses 3 and 4, are very emphatic, aren't they? First, Paul describes where these people are coming from in negative terms, how much they dislike the truth. And then secondly, he describes them in positive terms, how eager they are for false teaching. Do you see those two things in verse 3? Negatively, they will not put up with sound doctrine. Positively, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. And then he repeats the whole description again. Negatively, they will turn their ears away from the truth. Positively, they will turn aside to myths. You can see Paul's not leaving Timothy with any illusions about the situation he's going to be working in for the foreseeable future. Timothy is made very well aware about the sort of people he's going to be preaching to. It's a very bleak picture that Paul paints for him. Now, I think that in itself has a lesson for us. There are some Christians who seem to think that it's our duty always to be upbeat, positive, expecting immediate blessing. Now, today, tomorrow. Whatever they're involved in, whatever Christian project or venture they undertake, they try to psych themselves up to believe that it is certainly going to be hugely successful, that it's going to bring great results. When they send out publicity for their new venture, they announce to us all that this is going to be fantastic, awesome, this is going to be the greatest Christian event Manchester has ever seen. And they seem to think that that's what faith means. Always believing that wonderful things are about to happen. And if you don't show that sort of certainty, they hint that you obviously lack faith. Well, in that sense, Paul lacks faith. Paul doesn't think there's going to be any fantastic, wonderful transformation in the situation in Asia, at least not in the short term. Paul thinks things are going to carry on spiralling downwards. That's his realistic assessment of the situation. And that's the way he wants Timothy to see things. He doesn't want Timothy buoyed up by a false expectation that revival is just round the corner. He doesn't say to Timothy, it's your duty in faith to claim immediate revival. For Paul and for Timothy, faith doesn't mean saying, I'm sure we're going to see great outpourings of blessing any day now. Faith means saying, however hard and however dark things become, I'm going to carry on doing the work God has given me to do. And I'm going to carry on honouring him regardless. I suppose what I'm driving at is this. If you're a believer, if you're a member of this church particularly, then you are involved in the work of the kingdom. We're working together to reach people in this area. We're working together to build a biblical church. And some of you are involved in particular ministries. You're teaching in Sunday school, or you're out knocking on doors, or you're preaching in nursing homes. Well, it may be that you find it hard to summon up any great expectation as you do that work. You go into the nursing home month after month, But if you ask yourself, in all honesty, am I really expecting to see a stream of conversions there? Well, then the answer is no. You say, well, I just can't see it happening. I just can't imagine it happening as things are. Well, what I'm saying is this: don't tear yourself to pieces about that lack of expectation. There's no command in the Bible to say that you must expect outpourings of blessing at any particular point in time. What the Bible does command is that you carry on doing the work that God has given you to do, and that you believe that God will honour it in His way, in His time, whatever that might be. Yes, of course, keep hoping for great blessings. Yes, keep asking God to send showers of blessing from above. But don't feel guilty if you find yourself saying, but I don't really feel the time is right for that. Paul didn't believe that the time was right for any great change in the situation in Asia. Paul was sure that nothing was going to change in Asia except for the worse in the short term. So let's see how Paul analyses the situation that's ahead for Timothy. On the one side, he says, men, people, will not put up with sound doctrine. The word sound just means healthy, wholesome. Paul says people won't want that clear, direct Bible teaching, Bible preaching about God and sin and the way of salvation through Christ, and about obedience to God's commands, and about a life of holiness. People won't want that sort of diet. So if Timothy does carry on preaching that sort of healthy, wholesome, food for the soul truth, Timothy's likely to get fewer and fewer hearers. And those who do come and listen to Timothy are likely to say after a few weeks that this isn't what they want. It's boring. It's unoriginal. It's heavy. It's depressing. It's narrow. It's offensive. They'll listen to Timothy only until he says something that cuts across their ideas, or something that rebukes their lifestyle. And then they'll go away telling people what a nasty piece of work Timothy really is. Timothy's going to be attacked to his face, and he's going to be attacked behind his back by people who just don't like plain, wholesome Bible doctrine. And meanwhile, on the other side, says Paul, people, to suit their own desires, will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. It's not that religion will go out of fashion. It's not that these people will abandon Christianity. It's just that they'll look for a more enjoyable version. One that suits their way of thinking. One that doesn't clash with their lifestyle. So they'll search out teachers who will tell them the things they want to hear. Things that flatter them and reassure them and make them feel good. They'll find teachers for themselves who will make them feel comfortable. Paul's quite sarcastic, isn't he, in the way he describes people's eagerness to be taught just what suits them. He says, they gather around them teachers to suit. Normally you'd expect teachers to have to gather pupils around them. But it's the other way around here. It's the pupils who are so eager to hear pleasant things that they gather the teachers. And they gather, says Paul, great numbers of them. They don't just listen to one man whom they trust, a man who sticks to one clear line. Instead, they chase around in every direction, listening to this man today and that woman tomorrow, chopping and changing. They think of truth as being sort of on offer in a serve-yourself buffet restaurant, where you can just pick up something from this plate here and something from that plate there and assemble the meal that tickles your palate. Maybe they're willing to have a whole string of different teachers. And maybe these teachers will say completely contradictory things. Ah, it doesn't matter, providing that they're all the things that we want to hear. This week they're off to a conference on transforming worship. And, oh, it was really brilliant, you know. I mean, the man who spoke at that conference, wow, he really made it exciting. And this week they're reading a book on Christian social action. And it's really fantastic. Amazing what people can do when they get moving. And then the week after that, they'll be listening to the latest star Bible teacher telling them how to get health, wealth and prosperity, with any number of thrilling anecdotes of how people who had nothing are now multimillionaires by following this formula of faith. And the next week they'll be listening to somebody else telling them how Jesus is going to return in 2007. And both these Bible teachers are really fantastic. And it never occurs to them to ask what the point is of starting programs of social action and transformation if Jesus is going to return in a few months' time. Or why they need health and wealth if the end of the world is next week. They've stopped asking if what they're hearing is true. All they're interested in is it exciting? Does it give me an emotional boost? Does it sound novel and thrilling? Paul says that's what happens. When people, and he's talking here about professing Christians, when they lose their appetite for wholesome teaching, they can get into anything. They'll collect for themselves lots of different teachers in an endless search for novelty and excitement. You know, it's like a modern teenager sitting watching TV. And they don't actually watch anything. They just browse, just flicking through the channels with the remote, never watching any of the channels for more than 2 minutes at a time, and then moving on to look for something more interesting. And Timothy is going to have to maintain his ministry in days when that's what people are like. So Paul said it once. They'll turn away from wholesome teaching, solid food, to look for something more attractive. Something that will scratch their ears where their ears are itching. And then he says it again. They turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths. It's truth they don't like. They find truth boring. Or maybe they find truth frightening or upsetting. What they prefer are myths, nonsense, fiction, fantasy. We talked earlier in this series about the sort of myths that Christians in Ephesus were turning to. Old Jewish legends, fascinating, fictional details that people had added to the Old Testament stories. Christians in Ephesus in Timothy's day didn't want to hear about God's holiness or about the death of Christ for sinners. That was old hat. They'd heard it lots of times before, and besides that, it was a bit uncomfortable, because if they really took those things seriously, it might affect the way they lived. But if somebody could tell them about Noah and what he did as a baby in the first few minutes of his life, wow, that was really awesome. His body was white as snow and red as the blooming of a rose, and the hair of his head and his long locks were white as wool, and his eyes beautiful. And when he opened his eyes, he lighted up the whole house like the sun, and the whole house was very bright. And thereupon he rose up in the arms of the midwife, opened his mouth, and conversed with the Lord of righteousness. There you are. That's a real detail from one of these Jewish myths. And that's what Timothy was competing with. And people love to hear that sort of stuff. Oh, it's so moving. It's so glorifying to God. And it's fiction. It's there to titillate people. It's there to entertain people. It's ice jelly and ice cream for people who have lost their appetite for solid food. Listen to this. These are the opening words of a best-selling Christian autobiography. The six-month-old baby wriggled. She lay naked on a cloth-covered table. A middle-aged woman leaned over the child, touching as she did so the point of a knife with her forefinger to make certain it was sharp. Satisfying herself that it was, she grabbed the tiny ankle kicking away on the dark cloth. A whimper left the young throat as blood spurted from a nick in the small heel. Mysterious guttural incantations came from the woman's throat. Her ceremony was almost over. The child had been bound to Satan by a blood tie. A foundation was laid for a life in bondage and sickness. A sudden gust of wind at the window flickered the curtains open and brought a flash of light into the darkened first floor room. The woman lifted the child from the table, dressed it, and returned it to its mother. And the woman who's writing the book is the baby, now 45 years on. It's amazing what she remembers, isn't it? But then as you read through the book, she's apparently got total recall of every conversation she's had in all her life. She can describe every room in which anything ever happened. It's simply fantasy. But it's sold as serious, edifying Christian literature. It's presented as truth. And you organise a series of meetings for a woman like that. And you put her on the platform to tell her story. And I will tell you, countless evangelical Christians will turn out to be titillated by her sensational revelations. But if the same Christians were invited to a meeting where a man of God was simply going to preach on the Ten Commandments, they'd turn up their noses and decide they were too busy. Christians are still fascinated by myths of every kind. Sensational stories about miracle workers. Reports from people who claim to have found the Ark on Mount Ararat. Or the site of the Garden of Eden in Armenia. Astonishing proofs that the end times are right upon us. Doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter how skimpy the evidence is. If it's new and if it's exciting, people want to know all about it, and they never ask, is it true? You may have noticed that somewhere along the line I've sort of skipped from Paul's description of the situation back in Ephesus to the situation we see in our country today. And yes, it does seem to me that Paul's description here fits so well what we see today. So little appetite for the truth among people who call themselves Christians. And so much hunger for myths of every sort. And those of you who do mix with a wide circle of Christian folk, you'll be able to judge for yourselves how accurate the picture is. Now again, seeing this here in the Bible, it does save us from tearing ourselves to pieces, doesn't it? Paul describes the situation Timothy's up against. And the point is this, it is not Timothy's fault if people aren't interested in what he's offering. Timothy doesn't need to feel that he's a failure when he sees people rushing off to listen to all sorts of teachers peddling nonsense and ignoring him, sidelining him. That's not a problem with him, it's a problem with them. You know, often Christians in churches which are committed to plain, wholesome Bible teaching, they're made to feel that there must be something wrong with them if they're not attracting a crowd. So you've got a little company of 20 or 30 believers, or 5 or 6 believers, but they're meeting week by week and they're listening to consistent, solid Bible teaching. And their leaders simply take them through the Bible, showing them what the Bible says, and speaking of Christ week by week and urging them to cling to the gospel of Christ and to live close to Christ, to live holy lives. And they're praying that others will be drawn to join them and that their work will grow. And so they do invite other people along to hear this Bible teaching. But most people who call themselves Christians aren't attracted. They come once or twice and then they make some comment about it's not their sort of thing, and or the worship isn't lively enough, or they want something that's more family oriented or whatever, and they don't come back. And meanwhile, the great concrete and glass tabernacle, and with all the neon lights on it, just down the road, that offers the latest, corniest, most spectacular Christian novelties. Well, the congregation there just seems to grow and grow. It adopts the Toronto blessing. And people flock there for the privilege of barking like a dog or giggling uncontrollably for half an hour. It holds seminars on meditation where Christians are taught what it feels like to be a tree or a stone. And the place is packed out for those things. And the folk back in that little Bible preaching church just wonder, what's wrong with us? Surely if God were with us, if God were pleased with what we're doing, we'd be drawing folk in. And they begin to feel that they're under some sort of curse or some sort of judgment. Well, Timothy might well have felt like that at times, but Paul won't have it. He simply says, look, Timothy, there are times when the tide of true spirituality goes out. And Christians, or people who call themselves Christians, they do lose all appetite for truth. And they prefer myths. And it's not you, Timothy, that's got a problem. It's them. Don't blame yourself, Timothy. So how is Timothy to handle such a situation? Well, Paul gives him 4 short, sharp, staccato commands in verse 5. Number 1, he says, but you keep your head in all situations. Literally, be sober in all situations. Paul says, whatever comes, Timothy, however quickly the scene is changing around you, however excited other people are getting over all sorts of different movements and ideas, you've just got to be steady. You've got to keep your own emotional and mental balance. Don't sink into depression. Don't become bitter. Don't start becoming agitated or go into a panic. Don't overreact. Don't withdraw into a negative Elijah-like, I am left. You've got to keep yourself sane, Timothy. You've got to stay sober. Try and look at situations rationally. Keep a rein on your emotions. Self-control is the key. You can think of a sea captain on the bridge, steering the liner through an appalling storm, and passengers and crew are in danger of panicking. Well, what's the captain's job? Well, his very first job is just to keep calm, isn't it? Keep thinking clearly, deciding rationally what needs to be done moment by moment, issuing clear instructions, not going into a frenzy and just shouting at people on every side. Let people see that he's not lost control. Paul wasn't a professional sailor, but he was in that position at least once. You can read in Acts 27 about Paul's voyage to Rome and how the ship he was on got caught in a storm and everybody else on board was panicking, and it was Paul who just had to keep calm and had to calm other people and had to make sure that they ate their food, because they were all so in such a panic that they were forgetting about things like food. And it was Paul who had to point out to the sailors the things that could be done to improve the situation. Well, now it's Timothy who's going to be on the bridge while the church rides out this storm, and that means he's got to be steady. He's got to keep his head. It's the first advice we give to anybody, isn't it? In any sort of crisis situation. Stay calm. Just stay calm. Whether it's that there's been some bigger problem in a family, and all the cousins and all the uncles and aunts are on the phone, and just stay calm. Stay calm. Whether it's a crisis in a church, whether it's some great emergency, it doesn't matter. Just stay calm. And that's what Paul's saying to Timothy. Stay calm. God is in control. We talk about some people as having a safe pair of hands. They're the sort of people we find reassuring, because we know that however much pressure they're under, they won't panic and they won't come to pieces and they won't just start shouting and wildly. They won't just start doing things on impulse. We need Christians who've got a safe pair of hands, and people who can stay calm. That's Paul's first counsel to Timothy. The second, he says, endure hardship. Yes, Timothy, it is going to be hard. Living through this sort of situation is going to be hard, because there are going to be people who are going to attack you and slander you. There are going to be people who are going to be out to get you and make your life a misery. There are going to be friends who will turn their back on you. And there are going to be people who will pretend to be friends and will meanwhile be trying to undermine you. Timothy, you could lose your job. You could be pushed out of that church in Ephesus. Anything could happen. Well, Timothy, it's going to be hard. Face up to that and endure it. Just accept the fact that there are some situations that you just have to live through. And this is one of them, Timothy. You've just got to endure it. You've just got to keep going day after day after day, remaining cheerful, doing your work, seeking to be contented before God and uncomplaining, and surviving. Survive it, Timothy. Endure the hardship and come out the other end. Don't let it break you. And then the third advice, bit of counsel he gives him, do the work of an evangelist. I don't know whether this means that there were some people in the early church who were set aside as evangelists, as distinct from pastors and elders, or whether Paul is just saying, look, Timothy, whatever else you do or don't do, remain a gospel man. Remain a man who centers his preaching on the gospel. In a time when people are going off on all sorts of tangents, Timothy, you can't hope to answer all the false teachings that are being thrown around. You can't hope to interact and confront all the possible heresies that are being thrown up by this dirty tide. But you can just keep preaching the central things. You can keep preaching the gospel. If you don't know how to address a particular confused idea, how to refute it, then preach positively, Timothy. Go back to basics and preach about God and about sin and about Christ and about the way of salvation and about what it means to be a Christian. Those are the great things that we sum up as being the gospel. And an evangelist in the end means somebody who focuses on those things. You know, a man like Timothy, in the situation he's facing, where people are listening to 1,000 different false teachers, all serving up different heresies, Timothy could just finish up chasing his own tail, couldn't he? Trying to keep track of all the different heresies that are turning up, trying to answer them all, trying to work out what's wrong with this one and what's wrong with that one. You can't do it in the end. The wiser thing to do is just to keep preaching the truth. Just to keep focusing on the great, unalterable truth. If people keep clear in their minds the gospel, then all the other confusions around the edges will eventually fall away, won't they? They'll just dissolve. Timothy, don't let yourself be distracted. Don't spend all your time and energy trying to follow all the confusing winds of doctrine that are blowing through Asia. Timothy, keep the big things in your mind and keep preaching them. And then the fourth thing he says, discharge all the duties of your ministry. And the word ministry here means your service, your work as a servant. Timothy, never forget that you're a servant. And God has put you as a servant into his household, his church, and he's given you particular duties to do. Just get on with them. Just get on with them. Each morning, make a list of the things that it's your duty to do that day, and just do it. Just work through them. Do the hardest ones first, the ones you least want to do, and then when you've done them, move on to the next. But just see them as duties and work through them. You know, it is easy, isn't it? In a time of crisis, to spend all our time threshing around, trying to come to terms with this, trying to handle our own feelings. Paul says if you simply got on with doing your duty, then things would become so much simpler. Four wonderful, wise bits of advice for Christians in difficult days. Keep calm. Be prepared for hardship and just live through it. Concentrate on the big things and see yourself as a servant with duties to do and get on with doing them. Well, may God help us to be faithful in our generation, in the time in which He's put us.